So nice to have you back, Dimitri.
Good to be with you.
And let's get started with what's going on right now in the United States. We had different voices coming out of the policymakers in the United States in the West. On one side, we've heard that Bloomberg was reporting that it seems that the NATO countries are putting some sort of pressure on Zelensky to go after negotiations to find a political settlement. And on the other hand, we've seen that Zelensky is just resisting, is saying that we want to continue the conflict. What's your take on what's going on right now in the mind of NATO countries and together with Zelensky?
Well, there's nothing going on in the minds of NATO countries. That's just an echo chamber with noise in it. What's going on in the United States is the recognition that there has been a palace coup in the White House, and Biden is no longer in charge. And those people who were advocating for rocket attacks on Russian territory have been sidelined. They've actually heard Putin at the Pentagon and realized that if they move forward with this plan, then they will lose the ability to fire rockets into Russia or anywhere else for that matter, because Russia has many means at its disposal and the United States has very few. And so the noise-making apparatus within NATO has been pretty much cut free from anything that made sense to them, and now they're just basically their random thoughts rattling around in their brains, and random words are coming out, but they don't have a policy with regard to the Ukraine. Now, there's also Zelensky, who has to have some sort of an act, right? He's an actor. He's a clown. He has to have some sort of a clown act. And so now he's talking about victory, which is the most ridiculous thing he could possibly talk about. But why not? Why not make that kind of noise? And the fact is that all of the best parts of the Ukrainian army are being absolutely demolished in Kursk, which is being clean of all Ukrainian forces, slowly but surely. And then the rest of the Ukrainian army is retreating on foot. They advance on various personnel carriers and tanks and trucks, etc. Then all of their equipment gets demolished, and then they retreat. They either surrender or they retreat on foot. But it's quite a lot of territory, so they retreat slowly. And so that's taking a long time. But basically, it's a slow motion route. So, given that, what chances are there of engaging the Russians in negotiations? And that word keeps getting reused, renegotiations. What sign is there anywhere that the Russians would be willing to negotiate rather than secure outright victory, which is what they're busy doing? The thing is that Russia has said what it wants to achieve, and it's achieving these things. There's some mission creep with regard to demilitarization of the Ukraine, because it had to take a detour and demilitarize all of NATO along the way. But it's doing that, and it's also coming up with lots of new technology so that it can neutralize the whatever remaining NATO threat there is at the end of this campaign. So what negotiation can there be? And so the UN meeting is interesting, because Lavrov is meeting with something like 20 different dignitaries from various countries. Russia is extremely active diplomatically. There's a lot of this sort of discussion which morphs from UN discussion to discussion of BRICS, which is coming right up. A lot of countries are preparing for that because it's a very important meeting, whereas the General Assembly meeting is just sort of legacy. The UN is legacy because it happens to be on the wrong territory. It happens to be on American territory. And that's a problem for a lot of countries, specifically for Russia. And so there's a lot of diplomatic activity going on. And then at the same time, you know, there are these strange characters who nobody knows who they are anymore. I mean, who is Zelensky? He's not the president anymore. You know, his term expired. Who is Biden when his wife is chairing White House cabinet meetings? He's clearly not the president either. And then you have the Starmer character, who's you know, the prime ministers of the UK are sort of kaleidoscopic, if you want a colorful way to refer to them. They're like insects that that, you know, are only alive for a few days to mate and lay eggs, except that the British prime ministers do not mate or lay eggs. So it's not a very good metaphor, I suppose. But, you know, there was this guy Starmer, who is going to be prime minister for another 3 weeks or something. And he said that he wants the sausages to be released. I believe that was his whole statement. I guess he was peckish. He was hungry. And he meant to say hostages in Israel, but he said sausages. So that's the level of seriousness of these people. And I don't see much of a reason to pay attention to them anymore. Life is elsewhere.
You mentioned Lavrov's plan to talk with many leaders. Do you think in these talks that he's going to implement, he's going to do, is the main issue would be the conflict in Ukraine, or something else would be much more important for Russia?
Well, I'm pretty sure that nobody in meeting him will bring up the Ukraine. That's just not polite. Okay. And there's no reason to do it, because that's Russia's business. So why would anybody want to meddle in Russia's business? There are lots of other things to discuss. The most important one is the unit, which is being introduced. It's been decided to be 40% gold and 60% a basket of currencies. Nobody knows what those currencies are yet, and what percentages will be assigned to those currencies. So there are probably some hasty trade deals, some promises being made, some reserve requirements being spelled out, lots of little issues to sort out. So that's one issue. The other one is various countries want to be in on this new exchange mechanism that BRICS is putting in, so that countries can trade with each other without ever touching a dollar or a euro. So again, countries have to implement this system. They have to put in place secure electronic networks and connections. Some countries already have the infrastructure for it. Others have to somehow buy it or borrow money to build it, or invite somebody to build it, or sign contracts with companies to build it. So Lavrov is the natural interlocutor on all of such topics. And again, this is not UN business. This is far more important than anything that the UN could possibly engage in at this point. It's a legacy organization. The Security Council is impaired because basically the United States will veto anything remotely anti-Israel and remotely anti-Ukraine. And so there's nothing happening there, and nothing will continue happening there.
And you talk about this new system, but who's going to prepare? Who's preparing countries for this type of system? Who knows how does it work, and who's going to prepare these countries to use this type of systems?
Oh, there's no who. There's more of a what, and it's going to be a consortium-based effort. The world seems to be inching towards a consensus that the New Development Bank, which I believe is headquartered in Shanghai, will take care of the infrastructure needs of this entire program. That seems to be fairly clear. It also has become fairly clear that the International Monetary Fund will have absolutely no role to play in any of it, because they they talked about holding the usual sorts of discussions with Russia, but then they got cold feet and ran away. So the IMF is not part of the picture anymore, it would appear, and it's been sort of jettisoned from the entire BRICS domain. And at the same time, Turkey is deadly serious about joining BRICS, it turns out, because not because of anything political, but because intelligent Turkish economists did the math and have figured out that there's no future for Turkey with the European Union, and that there's really no reason to stick around NATO now that NATO has shown itself to be defunct. And so they're actually very interested in joining BRICS. And as a BRICS member, they will be a go-between between what remains of the European Union. We'll see how it crumbles in the future, and Russia and the rest of the world. So that's a major shift. That's something really to pay attention to.
And Stoltenberg was talking about how to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine. Here is what he said, Dmitry.
That we can change President Putin's mind, but we can change his calculus. So if the price he has to pay on the battlefield is too high, then he may be willing to sit down and agree a solution where Ukraine prevails as a sovereign independent nation. And to get there, we need military support to Ukraine, because that's the only way to convince President Putin that they will not win on the battlefield.
Is he talking about...
Yeah, go ahead.
Is he talking about long-range missiles?
Who knows what he's talking about? He's doing this, right? And that tells you that tells you what his state of mind is. He's pretty much in agony. His legacy is zero. What he's achieved is nothing. He said these same words before. We must raise the price for Putin in order to change his mind and bring him to, drag him kicking and screaming to the negotiating table so we can give him an ultimatum and blah, blah, blah. So what significance does any of that have? Absolutely none. I mean, first of all, we have to support the Ukraine with what? The Ukraine has already received all of the weapons it could from NATO countries and has overseen the process of Russia destroying them. So, for instance, there was a great deal of discussion of air defense, and there was even talk of a no-fly zone over the Ukraine, if you recall. So what happened to Ukrainian air defense systems? That the Ukraine no longer has any air defense, and Russia can do whatever it wants in Ukrainian airspace without any risk whatsoever. And so that's done. Are they going to give, the Americans going to give the Ukrainians more Abrams tanks? Well, those tanks burn really well and get stuck in the mud and are generally useless. And most of the ones that were already given have been destroyed with nothing to show for it. Are they going to give the Ukrainians a few more artillery shells? Well, that's a drop in the bucket compared to what the Russians keep sending to the front. They keep using this method of artillery barrages until there's nothing left, and then they move forward. And they'll continue doing that. So what is he talking about? Nothing. He's just producing hot air like he usually is. And he's doing this with his hands, which tells you that he's hysterical. And, at least he's not doing this, which is what Hitler did. The worse things got for him at the front, the more he was pounding his fist in the air. As far as fist pounding in the air, that is more the counselor. If you look at his recent speeches, he's doing that Hitler thing. with the fist in the air. So I think he's in even worse shape.
And when it comes to Ukraine, and you mentioned that Zelensky is no longer the president of Ukraine, but in terms of having any sort of election in Ukraine, do you think that would change? How do you find, do we know anything about the Ukrainian people? How do they feel about the current phase of the conflict? Because all we know about the Zelensky, about Zelensky and his administration, but how about the people of Ukraine, those people who are still living in Ukraine, who are not necessarily in line with Zelensky and his policies in the continuation of the conflict? They may want to live in that region without having any sort of problem with Russia or even with the European Union. Can we hear, do we know anything about them? Because these people are voiceless. Nobody's talking about them.
Well, they're not just voiceless, but they know better than to open their mouths. Because opening your mouth can lead to your death, or at least cause you to get beat up or locked up by Zelensky's thugs. There is no opposition in the Ukraine, political opposition. They've all been, they've either fled the country or they've been killed or they're in prison. There are a lot of political prisoners in the Ukraine, which is something that nobody talks about. People know better than to venture forth with their political opinions, should they have any. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, there are a lot of brainwashed people in the Ukraine who watch television, and in order to not go insane, they've sort of gaslighted themselves into supporting Zelensky and being patriotic and supporting the military, except when the military comes to draft them, in which case they run away. So that's just words and deeds don't really agree with each other. And then there are a lot of people who are very, very patriotic, and then they pay a huge bribe to get out of the Ukraine, and then they remain very, very patriotic because they know that if you're a patriotic Ukrainian in Europe, you stand out than if you are, say, pro-Russian. So given that this is what the politics in the Ukraine are like these days, how likely is it that the pro-Russian majority in the Ukraine is actually going to step forward and vote for peace with Russia? Well, no chance at all. The way people should look at it is that it's not a war with Russia. Russia intervened for humanitarian reasons, but it's really a civil war within the Ukraine itself.
And the other point would be right now, and do you find it, the way that they're talking about the continuation of the conflict, do you find it still related to the 2024 presidential election in the United States, or they're really thinking of having the continuation of the conflict? They're thinking that they can weaken Russia through this process.
Well, I don't think that now that Russia has recovered economically and is, I think, the third fastest growing economy in the world after China and India, I don't think anybody sane believes that any of this was useful for quote unquote weakening Russia. If you try to weaken something and it becomes stronger, then you probably aren't weakening it and maybe should try something else. Now, the point is that there's nothing to be done from the point of view of trying to weaken Russia. Those are just basically words that people use. It's not happening. And in terms of the presidential election, well, Putin said that Harris is his choice. So we're just waiting for Kamala Harris to get elected. There's nothing else to pay attention to. And if that doesn't happen, well, we'll have Trump for 4 years. But what difference does that make? It doesn't matter who is the president in the United States. The country is going to go in the same direction regardless of who's in the White House.
It seems that in the European Union, Macron recently was talking about having relationship with Russia in the aftermath of this conflict. Do you think that they have started thinking about putting an end to the conflict in terms of their mind in the European Union. Because Macron was one of the leaders when this conflict started. He really wanted to have some sort of negotiations between when this conflict started between the West and Russia. And during this conflict, we've seen that he has changed his position totally. And right now, it seems that he's getting back to his first position. How do you find it right now in the European Union in terms of France?
In terms of France, France is a country with a very strange government where people vote a set of parties and another set of parties is in government. Also, the French are quite vehement, most of them, that Macron should not be the president, that he should resign, and yet he's not resigning. And that is part of an overall pattern. So Macron had a pretty good relationship with Putin and with Russia, except that at one point he had confidential discussions with Putin, which were designated as confidential, and then turned around and leaked the whole thing to the press, causing the Russians to say, okay, we won't talk to Macron ever again. Because that's a typical sort of reaction when somebody behaves so dishonorably. So Macron is never going to talk to any Russians ever again. That is something to understand. He's a political corpse, the way the Russians think about it. A political corpse. And why would a political corpse get involved in something that is, from the Russian point of view, an internal affair? Because the Ukraine at this point is, for the Russians, an internal. Well, no reason at all. Whatever Macron is saying, he has to somehow fill space and appear before audiences so that people remember his name, remember that he's still sort of the president. What difference does it make? It doesn't make any difference at all. Macron is very eager to make sure that France continues to receive enriched uranium from Russia, because without it, it's lights out in France. So that's the one thing that he should be focusing on. Everything else is secondary.
Dmitry, you mentioned that Russia would decide about this conflict on the battlefield, but we know at the end of the day, as Peskov pointed out, at the end of the day, there has to be some sort of negotiations, because without having negotiations, it's not possible to put an end to this conflict. In your opinion, what would be the conditions that Russia would consider for any sort of negotiations? How do you see that path?
Well, look, Napoleon invaded Russia and negotiated his way. Well, by losing, I think, 90% of his army and abandoning it and fleeing to Paris. Hitler invaded Russia and negotiated his way out, all the way to shooting himself in the head in the bunker. Americans, with their Ukrainian proxies, invaded Russia. And now that Kursk has been violated, that's an actual invasion of Russian territory, as opposed to a Russian limited intervention in what was at that point a foreign instigated civil war within the former Ukraine. So what will happen to Washington? Will they negotiate themselves to the point where the United States is no longer united? That could happen. The point is, you don't attack Russia and then expect to end with negotiations. You expect to end with unconditional surrender, and people should really get it through their heads. And if they can't, they should study some history.
But in the eyes of the United States, is the same as you've mentioned? Because it seems that they're thinking of this conflict differently. They don't see the conflict the way that Russia, and as you've mentioned, is seeing right now.
Well, no, that's changed. Okay, so the people in the White House until very recently perhaps had the worldview that that made them think that they could attack Russia and Russia wouldn't attack them. That, okay, well, maybe the Ukraine will be engulfed in nuclear flames and maybe Russia will even attack Europe. And wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? Americans really don't care about the Europeans. But the United States, of course, would be inviolate because the moment the United States gets touched, it's World War III and the world goes up in flames and the Russians would never do that. So Putin put an end to that line of thinking. Not Putin personally, his Minister of Defense, Belousov, has contacts with the Pentagon. In spite of everything, there are still lines of communication open. I think what he did was he sent over a target list of objects within the United States that would be destroyed if long-range rockets were used by NATO members staged on Ukrainian territory against Russian territory. And the Pentagon people looked at it and said, well, yeah, okay, we need to step down, and called the White House and said, you basically maneuvered us into a military dead end where if we make a move, we get destroyed and we have nothing in response. And so let's not do this. And that's when the palace coup in the White House happened. That's when Blinken got sidelined. That's when Biden was told that he never makes any decisions again, which is a good thing. He won't be blowing up any more Nord Stream pipelines, I guess. Suddenly it turned out that there won't be any rockets sent into Russia. There won't be. Which is a very reasonable thing to do. You see, the political people, they don't understand anything. So they kept talking about these attackums, for instance, rockets, which the Russians can shoot down all day. There really is nothing that the West has that the Russians don't know how to shoot down very effectively. So all of these attacks on Russian territory are futile, except that the United States will get hurt as a result. So, for instance, if a certain rocket is used to attack Russia, the Russians will shoot down that rocket, and then they will shoot down the factory that makes that rocket in the United States to make sure that there are no more of those rockets. That will be the plan. Because the U.S. territory, given Russia's new weapons system, is basically a Russian playpen as far as being able to shoot at it with impunity. And what states response? Oh, they shot down our factory. Therefore, let's start World War III and attack Russia with nuclear weapons, and Russia will respond, and we will all die. Is that the plan? Will Americans kill themselves using Russia if Russia lives up to the promise and attacks objects on the ground, military installations, military factories on the ground in the United States? No, it wouldn't. It would suck it up. It would just basically fold, realize that, you know, it's done, and do nothing, and say, please don't do this again, and we'll be nice from now on. So that's what's happening now, is the entire political neocon thrust of let's weaken Russia, let's drag Russia kicking and screaming to the negotiating table so that we can deliver our ultimatum and draw lines on the map where we wish them to be. That's done. That's over.
You mentioned how Pentagon changed the mindset in Washington. Do you think we are witnessing a moment that people who understand the war, who understand the consequences of any sort of war between the United States and Russia, are prevailing in the United States, or we can say the technical people are prevailing? are just winning over ideological people.
The ideology is definitely dead. The neocon has been shown to be suicidal. And the difference is that the military people in the Pentagon are not suicidal. They're looking forward to their next promotion, to retirement, to working as consultants for a military contractor and getting huge salaries and then buying a big yacht, you know, and sailing around and drinking in marinas in Virginia somewhere. I've been on a boat in Virginia and I've talked to those retired Pentagon people. That's their dream. That's what they want. They don't want to die in a nuclear flame. They don't want to spend the rest of their life in a short, though it will be, it locked up in some nuclear bunker. They don't want that. And they're realists in the sense that they know what the result of a certain action will be. So the Russians told them what they will do. And the Russians said they didn't threaten. They just basically said, here's what we'll do if you do X. If you do X, we will do Y. That's a promise. And so the Americans said, okay, therefore, we will not do X because Y is bad for us. Okay, so there, if you talk about ideology, ideology is something else. This is not ideology. This is arithmetic. It's military arithmetic, but it's still just arithmetic. You do not sustain a level of damage you cannot afford to sustain. First rule of war. So there are people in the Pentagon smart enough to know that. And that's what happened.
Reuters reported that Russia is talking with Houthis through Iran, the government in Iran, to send them missiles in order to confront the United States. Do you think that, first of all, how do you find this report? Does it have anything with the reality? They're making it.
Whose report is it?
Reuters.
Oh, yeah, they dreamt that up, probably. You see, they have a university and several institutes devoted to the research of rocketry and has made major breakthroughs. I don't think they got rockets from Russia, but they may have received some Russian scientific papers from Russia, and enough of them know how to read Russian to have figured it out. So the Houthis can make their own rockets, thank you very much. They're very good at it. They're smart people. And so it wasn't necessary for Russia to send rockets to Houthis, you know, which is an uncertain thing. There isn't really a secure line of communication, of logistical line, you know, from Russia to Yemen, but the Houthis have a very impressive stockpile of weapons of a kind that the Americans have no idea how to make, and that is rather significant. And they have proven that they can reach Israel in 11 minutes. From Yemen, which is hypersound, and they can hit a target, such as a military base in Israel. So that seems like a really good demonstration from their point of view. That was pretty much all that they were striving for, and they demonstrated their ability, their proven ability. In terms of what that they came up with, I don't know. They make things up.
Yeah. And the other thing would be the outcome of this conflict in Ukraine in terms of other conflicts in the Middle East and with China. Do you think that we are getting to the point that we would see more confrontations between Russia and China and the United States? Or we are witnessing some sort of understanding, because if you do this, we're going to do that in Africa, for example, in the Middle East. Is it going to make some sort of sense in the mind of policymakers to go after some sort of diplomacy, or we're going to have more confrontation?
I think neither. I think the United States is depleted in terms of its ability to influence things beyond its borders. The United States at this point hardly has the money to repatriate its troops from all the military bases it has scattered all over the world. You have to understand the state of the United States and specifically the U.S. military, the utter state of decrepitude reached on every level. For instance, it just sent an aircraft carrier, Harry S. Truman, to the Middle East. For what purpose? It already knows that it cannot reach any of the areas that it might bomb in the Middle East without mid-air refueling, and those mid-air refueling tankers are, you know, they're very easy targets. And at the same time, it knows that everybody now has rocketry that can reach the aircraft carrier if it's within 300 nautical miles of any coast. So what use is an aircraft carrier in that instance? But that's not all. To make the situation worse, the only refueling tanker ship that the Americans had just ran aground in the Gulf of Aden. And so the only way the aircraft carrier group can now be refueled is by docking somewhere. So what is it going to sprint to the Middle East and then sprint out again for refueling every time? How useful is that? And the Americans are talking about building more of those ships, but the one that they have ready to go isn't, which keeps happening to them. They build something and then it turns out to not work. And so nobody knows when it'll actually be certified for active duty beyond territorial waters. And other ships of the sort that they were planning to build are backordered, and nobody knows when they're going to be built. So that's just one example, right? That's one example. The nuclear navy that was the pride of the United States is now useless, completely useless. How much more of these assets that the Americans think they have are completely useless? And you have to keep in mind that the rest of the world, Russia and China, are moving forward faster than ever before in terms of weapons development and in terms of their ability to project power anywhere in the world, leaving the United States far behind. So what does that mean? It means that the United States has been outdone and should basically duck out. Should stick to its own business.
Yeah. And talking about the conflict in the Middle East, as you mentioned, right now we're having some sort of conflict tensions, growing tensions between Israel and Hezbollah. And do you understand what's the necessity of having this conflict? We had those bombings in Lebanon, and right after that, after these bombings, we had pagers and walkie-talkies bombings, and then they bombed Lebanon by using fighter jets. Netanyahu coming out talking about these are Hezbollah is responsible for what's going on in Lebanon. We are not doing that. We are not your enemies. And do you understand what would be the policy of the United States in the Middle East? Because it doesn't seem that they're having any sort of policy when it comes to Netanyahu and his administration. He's just doing everything as he just desires, everything he desires to do.
Well, Netanyahu is pretty much a loose cannon, but you have to understand that, you know, if the war ends, he goes to jail. And the war isn't going very well because he said that Hamas would be taken care of in 2 weeks, and it's been a year, and Hamas is nowhere near being taken care of. And now nobody wants to trade with Israel because it's a genocidal state. It killed lots of women and children, and nobody wants to talk to it. And the Israeli economy has fallen apart because the port of Eilat on the Red Sea, the biggest port that Israel had, is bankrupt and closed and cannot operate because of the Houthis. And so what choice did Netanyahu have except to enlarge the problem by attacking Hezbollah in southern Lebanon? But you have to remember the history. So the first Lebanon war that Israel fought allowed Israel to occupy southern Lebanon for a while. Eventually, they pulled out. The second Lebanon war that Israel fought was a defeat for Israel, a humiliating defeat. And since then, Hezbollah has become stronger and has secured its relationship with more allies in the region. So you expect this new war that Netanyahu has started to be an even greater defeat for Israel, a real huge humiliating defeat, especially considering that the Israeli military is already worn out from this useless fighting in the Gaza Strip. And so the only reason Netanyahu could have thought that this is a good idea is because he thought that this is a way to get the Americans to move in and help. But the Americans do not want to start any more wars. They're incapable of doing anything useful in the Ukraine, and they're incapable of doing anything useful in the Middle East. They realize that now. And so I think that this terrorist strike using pagers and walkie-talkies was actually U.S. orchestrated because it was a surprise for the Israelis. The Israelis, when that happened, started to scramble to move their troops north to the Lebanese border. They actually pulled a tank brigade out of the Gaza Strip, which is an emergency measure. There were traffic jams all over Israel as they were moving equipment around on flatbeds, trying to maneuver it to the northern frontier. So clearly, if an element of surprise was intended, it surprised the Israelis as much as anyone else. The only people who were warned of the attack were the doctors at the American hospital in Beirut, who were ordered to surrender their pagers before the attack. They had those same pagers. Those pagers were taken away from them ahead of time. This is the American hospital in Beirut, not any other. So what does that tell you? That tells you that this was an American provocation, a terrorist attack, which the Americans are so. And the purpose of it was to make sure that the Israelis are painted as terrorists, because this was instantly pinned on them by the New York Times and other Western agencies. They were instantly blamed, that the Americans will not help terrorists, and the Israelis are now terrorists, so the Americans won't help them. And to duck out of what are actually, I think, their more or less treaty responsibilities to help Israel. But, you know, Americans always reinterpret whatever agreements they make in their favor. So in this case, they will not help Israel in their war against Lebanon. And now that Israel has started this war, it will probably end badly for them, more badly than the second war in Lebanon ended, I believe, in 2006.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dmitry, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Thank you.